So as I said, it's Parsha Shoftim. I need to give the same introduction I gave last week and be honest and say that today will be a lot of review from years gone by since I've been I've been a little distracted, so I'll be honest, I didn't have a lot of time to prepare, so hopefully it'll pay off and we'll celebrate tonight. But for today, I didn't want to cancel the shiur, because the whole point is to celebrate learning and to keep learning and to keep growing and learning. So I don't want to do that. But so I thought a bit of review won't hurt. Okay, so it's quite a fundamental parsha actually. So let's have a look at the very beginning of the parsha, where the parsha tells us a mitzvah, one of the 613 mitzvahs. Now again, in context of where Devarim is written, this is a mitzvah given to the Jewish people as they prepare to enter the land of Israel. And in entering the land of Israel, they're going to set up structures, and they're going to set up society structures to live as a functional people. So the Torah gives the following mitzvah. It says, Shoftim v'shoitrim, judges and officers, titein lecha b'chol she'arecha, you shall place for yourself in all of your gates, meaning all your cities, asher Hashem alakecha noisen lecha l'shvatecha, which Hashem your God is giving to you, to your tribes. In other words, each tribe had their own portion, had their own city, and so on. And the function of those judges and officers is v'shoftu esa'om mishpat tzedek. They will judge the people a righteous judgment. Right? So it's batei din, based in courts and so on and so forth. Interesting, by the way, the expression here is judges and officers. And of course, the commentaries explain that the difference between a judge and an officer is that the judge is the one to rule, and the officer is the one to implement the rule, to ensure that the judgment, that the ruling is implemented. I say that because it's a very interesting prophecy with regard to the time of Mashiach, where it says, V'oshiva, it's one of the haftorahs we just read recently, it says, V'oshiva shoiftayich k'varishoina, I will bring back your judges as it was in olden times, V'yatzayich k'vatchila, and your counselors like it was in the beginning. And model on that, we have the bracha we say in Shmoneh Esra, where we say, Hashiva shoifteinu k'varishoina, we ask Hashem to bring back the judges, the court system the way it was in times of old, the Yatzeinu k'vatchila, and counselors the way it was in the beginning. So when it comes to Mashiach times, we don't mention the officers part of the equation, the policemen part of the equation, right? Just judges, but not officers. And the reason, of course, is because up until the time of Mashiach, there's two parts of the process. There's a process to rule and to paskin and to develop judgments and legislation. But then there could be resistance to implementing that legislation, and therefore the Torah has to give another mitzvah to implement a officer system, a police system, if you want, to actually make sure and ensure, to enforce and make sure that it's all properly implemented. But when Mashiach will come, where we hopefully, Yemir Hashem, soon will live in an era where Hashem says He will remove impurity from the world, where people will have the moral conscience the way they should have it, and therefore will be willing to do whatever they need to be doing, whatever the moral thing is to be doing, there won't be a need for law enforcement. There'll just be a need to legislate. We won't know always what the answer is, and we'll need a body of people who will be able to do that. But there won't be a necessity for law enforcement, and therefore we don't have that expression when Mashiach comes. But up until then, we have the concept of shoytrim and shoytrim. Right? And one other thought we said before, we talk about Elul. So the Ba'alei Musar, the master of ethics, all say that we always read Parashat Shoftim in Elul, in the month of Elul. Of course, Elul is a time of reflection, it's a time to review our whole conduct, it's a time to do tshuva, it's a time to reconnect and prepare for the new year. And they say that this pasuk is not only a pasuk said to a nation who's setting up a society structure, but it's also to individuals, that we all have the gates of our own city, the mouths, the eyes, the ears, and so on and so forth. And the Torah is reminding us that part of the tshuva process is shoftim v'shoitrim, place judges, place safeguards around what we hear and what we talk and what we say and what we eat and what we look at and what we absorb and so on. So therefore, the various gates of our own city need to be protected. That's on a more spiritual level. Okay, let's go back to what the pasuk says. So the pasuk says, verse 19 says, loisate mishpat, you shall not distort the judgment. Loisaku ponim, don't favor anyone. Velesikach shoichad, do not take any bribery. Ki ashoichad yaver enei chachamim, the bribery will only blind the eyes of the wise. Visalat divrei tzadikim, and distort the words of the righteous. Tzedek, tzedek, tirdoif, pursue justice, proper justice, moral justice. Leman tichye v'yarashta sa'aretz, in order that you should live and inherit the land, asher Hashem alekecha noisein lach, which Hashem, your God, is giving you. Okay. And then there's a few other mitzvahs. Then, if you go to the next page, the middle of the page, Pasuk Ches. Here, the Torah turns away from the regular courts that were in every city and turns its attention to the Sanhedrin. Right? In times of old, the legislative system, in terms of the oral Torah, was headed by the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin were a high court. The high court system started all the way back from the times of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the high court sat in Yerushalayim, and they were the supreme court of Klal Yisrael. The Torah tells us the following: Ki yipolei mimcha dover lamishpot. If something, a matter of judgment, is gone away from you, you don't know the answer to something. Bein dam ledam, bein din ledin, whether it's to do with blood, whether it's to do with judgment, bein nega lenega, what's to do with impurities, the plagues, and so on. Divrei rivois b'sherecha, what's got to do with quarrels or conflicts that are happening in various cities. The kamta ve'aliso, you should get up and go up. El hamokem ha'shivcha Hashem elokecha bo, go to the place that Hashem has chosen, i.e. the Beis HaMikdash, the temple. Uvoso el hakoyanim, you will come to the priests, halavim, or the Levites, or l'shoifet, or the judges, ashiyeh b'yom ha'mehem. They shall be in those times. Ve'darashto v'higidu l'cha, and they will interpret, and they will tell you, Ace Dvar HaMishpat, the answer to that particular judgment ruling. Ve'asisa, and you shall then do, Al pi ha'dover ashe agidu l'cha, you shall do what they tell you to do, min ha'mokei mahu, ashe yivchar Hashem, from that place which God will choose. Ve'shamarta la'asois, you should protect and safeguard and implement, k'choil asher yoyrucha, everything that they teach you to do. Al pi ha'torah, according to the Torah, according to the teachings, asher yoyrucha, they will teach you. Vala mishpat, according to the judgment, asher yom lecha, which they will instruct you, tasa, you shall do. Loisasur, do not deviate, min hadavar asher yagidu lecha, whatever they tell you, yomin usmoil, right or left. Okay. Now this is a very, very fundamental paragraph, and I'm going to sort of develop it with you in the next few minutes. On the surface, what the Torah is saying, contextually, something very simple, that there were courts in every city which judged local matters. People had disputes, people had lawsuits, people had questions, whatever the case is. They came to their local based in, they asked the question, they got the answer. If they were unable to answer the question, they would then refer it to a higher court, and ultimately, if no one knew the question, they would go to the court of 71 judges, who would then have to deliberate and debate or discuss the halacha, and they would then vote. If they were in conflict, they would also vote, right? That's why it was always 71. A Beis Din was always an odd number for that reason, because the way it works in Torah law is that a Beis Din on all matters work by majority. So if there's a question, there's a conflict, they vote, and the voting system is then follows the majority, right? And then the answer they would give would be the final halacha, and they would then implement that. So that's on a simple level. However, it's much deeper than that, because what the Torah is actually referring to is the very basis of the system we have in Torah law called Torah Shebal Peh. Torah Shebal Peh, the oral Torah, and the authority that was invested in the ordained and qualified legislators to interpret law, to interpret the Torah Shebal Peh, to implement new ideas, new concepts, rabbinic laws. And the Torah is saying that it becomes obligatory to follow that system, right? I'll give you an example of what I mean. So the Gemara twice asked the following question. It's a Gemara in two places, one in Shabbos, one in Megillah, where the Gemara asked the following question. The Gemara says, what bracha do you make when we light Hanukkah candles, right? Or the same question is asked, what bracha do we make when we read the Megillah on Purim? So the Gemara says, the normal bracha of the mitzvah, Asher, we bless Hashem, Asher kiddushanu b'mitzvayso v'tzivanu, Hashem has sanctified us with His mitzvahs and has commanded us lahadlik ner Chanukah, to kindle ner Chanukah, or lishma Megillah, to read the Megillah, or lahadlik ner Shabbos Kodesh, or to light the Shabbos candles. Right? These are all rabbinic mitzvahs. So that's what we say. We say we thank Hashem that has sanctified us and has commanded us to do these mitzvahs. So the Gemara asks the question, v'heichan tzivana? Where's the commandment? You can look at the whole Torah, you will not find anywhere where it says light Shabbos candles or light Chanukah candles or read the Megillah. Why won't you find it? Because these are not Torah laws. They're rabbinic laws. They came in the time of the later on, right? They were legislated, they were made in time. So the Gemara answers, no, of course the Torah told us to light Chanukah candles. Where? In this week's parasha. And it quotes this pasuk, which is in the bottom of page 1026, where it says, "Lo yisaser min hadavar asher yagidu lecha yamin u'smol." Do not deviate from what they tell you to do, right or left. In other words, once a rabbinic mitzvah has been established, it becomes Torah law to the point, says the Gemara, that you can make the bracha asher kiddushanu b'mitzvaysa v'tzivanu, that Hashem has sanctified us with His mitzvahs and He's commanded us to do this mitzvah. So when we light Chanukah candles or Shabbos candles or Megillah, even though they're all rabbinic mitzvahs, or Hallel we read today, if all these things are rabbinic mitzvahs, but yet we make a bracha on them because it's as if the Torah has told us to do it. Where's the source? This week's parasha. So that whole system of oral Torah, rabbinic law, and so on and so forth is all rooted in a few places, but mainly in this week's parasha. And I want to just sort of go through with you the structure of how that all works. Okay. First of all, a very simple thing. The specific thing that the Torah is referring to here is the Sanhedrin. Why am I saying that? Because the system of the oral Torah actually continues until today in a different form, but the Torah here is making specific reference to a Sanhedrin or the Batei Din, the Beis Dins that were around at that time. Why do I say that? Because who was qualified to sit on a Beis Din? Right? So obviously there had to be distinguished Torah scholars, there had to be people who were Yirei Shemayim, they were God-fearing Jews and so on and so forth, but also they had to have smicha. Now, most people have heard of the name smicha today, but it's not the same smicha. Okay. The smicha that we talk about that the Sanhedrin had was a different type of smicha. It was a... First of all, you know what the word smicha means? Everyone talks about smicha. A rabbi has smicha. What does smicha mean? Ordination. No, it actually doesn't mean ordination. I mean, the translation is not ordination. No. It means to lean on. Why? Where did it start from? Where does the term smicha come from? It's an interesting fact. The term smicha comes from the following. Moshe Rabbeinu was, of course, chosen by God to be the Jewish leader, the one to give us the Torah. And Moshe Rabbeinu, in the groups of 40 days following the event of the giving of the Torah, he went up on the mountain to learn the oral Torah, to learn all the mitzvahs that aren't explicit in the Torah, to learn the rules that we have to interpret the Torah. Right? The whole system was given to him in those 120 days. When Moshe Rabbeinu was coming towards the end of his life, Hashem told him, you need to ordain Yehoshua, the next generation, pass on the chain. How do you do it? You have to give from your countenance, from your qualifications, you have to give it over to Yehoshua. The way Moshe Rabbeinu did that was to actually physically place his hands on Yehoshua and ordain him. That's the way it was done. Ever since then, it became known as smicha, because that's what Moshe Rabbeinu did. In future generations, they didn't do that, but what they did do was they took the authority, invested in themselves, and passed it on to the next generation. So when someone had smicha in those days, right, it meant that they had the smicha that was given to them from someone who had the smicha that was given to them all the way back to the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, right? Which came to an end eventually. I'm trying to remember exactly when it came to an end. It came to an end like a couple hundred years after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. Okay? So we don't have that smicha today. Today, smicha is just a degree. So you learn a certain amount of knowledge and you get tested and you have the ordination and you're a rabbi, right? But we don't have that original smicha that was passed down from generation to generation. I'll tell you an interesting thing, that when the second temple was destroyed, right? There was a very, very famous, which is highlights the whole concept of the way the transmission of Torah learning and how important it is. When the second temple was destroyed under the Romans, just before it was destroyed, there's the famous story in the Gemara where Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, one of the greatest leaders, managed to sneak out of Yerushalayim, which was under siege, and managed to get an audience by Vespasian, the Roman general who later became the Roman emperor. A whole story. Essentially, Vespasian asked him, "What do you want?" So he said to him, "I understand you're going to destroy Yerushalayim. It was imminent. I understand you're going to destroy the temple. But what I need from you is just a few things. I want you to preserve the Sanhedrin. I want you to allow the Sanhedrin and its rabbis to go out of Yerushalayim and to go relocate to a place called Yavne. Right? And also I want you to preserve the leader of the Sanhedrin called Rabban Gamliel and a couple other things." Anyway, Vespasian thought that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had gone completely crazy. He was about to come and destroy the whole Jewish infrastructure. He was about to destroy the whole headquarters of Jewish activity, which was the temple. He thought that would be the end of the Jewish nation. What's this guy asking for a couple of rabbis to go learn Torah and to set up a Jewish court somewhere in Yavne? He said, "Gesundheit, no problem, go for it." And they did. And what happened after the temple was, the temple was destroyed, it was devastating, it was terrible. But actually, Jewish activity thrived. In fact, what's amazing is, in the generations to follow, in land of Israel and subsequently in Babylon, where most of the Jews were at the time, under tremendous, tremendous persecution and difficulty, the oral Torah and Jewish learning thrived like never before. The Mishnah and the Gemara, people forget this. Most of the Mishnah and Gemara, which is the source and foundation of Jewish learning today, was all written and recorded after the destruction of the Second Temple in the diaspora. Mainly there's a lot of it in Israel, but a lot of it outside of Israel as well, right? And it took a couple of generations for the Romans to realize they made a terrible error. They thought by coming in and destroying Yerushalayim, the Beis HaMikdash, it would be a devastating blow, which it was. But they thought it was the end of the Jewish people. They suddenly realized that they allowed this whole Sanhedrin thing to go on, which came together with an extreme hub of Jewish learning, and Jewish life essentially was under pain, but it was still alive, and it continued to be alive, and it's still alive today, right? So what they then did is they shifted. And it was a couple of generations later where they enacted a decree that smicha was forbidden, because they wanted to interrupt the chain, right? And they said something like, whoever has smicha and bestows it and gives it to the next generation, the neighboring cities within a particular radius will be killed, and that person will be killed. So I think it was Rabbi Yehuda ben Bobba, if I'm not mistaken, if I remember correctly, knew that it was critical that the Sanhedrin continues. So he took 5 students. He went and he stood in a valley between 2 mountains that was far away from any city within that radius. And he gave 5 students smicha and then he ran away. And he was subsequently caught and killed. But the smicha continued, right? But later on, it actually came to an end. And today we don't have Bote Din, we don't have a Sanhedrin like we used to have. We have still Jewish courts, but we don't have that type of Sanhedrin because we don't have that kind of smicha, which limits the authority of a Beis Din today. They cannot do things that a Beis Din of old could do. They can just basically rule cases, and they can ask questions, and they can rule on disputes that people come, but they can't punish, they can't enact fines. We don't have that structure like we used today. However, we still have the structure of Torah Shabbat Peh. Now, going back to the original Sanhedrin, so what was their function coming from this week's parasha? So their function was threefold. Number one, their function, their purpose was to answer questions that were too difficult for anyone else to answer, rather than any other Beis Din couldn't answer, so, right? Number two, if new questions came about, their function was to interpret the written Torah properly so that they could understand what the halacha is. If things that weren't dealt with before or had been forgotten, or this is a very long discussion, I'm some sort of summarizing it a bit, right? They had to interpret the Torah Shebaal Peh, the Torah Shebichtav, using the rules of Torah Shebaal Peh, Torah Shebichtav and using the interpretation rules. Or, third thing is, their function was to make new decrees. So, for example, many of the laws that today we have on Shabbos, which are the precautionary decrees, like, for example, not touching muktzah on Shabbos, right? Simple example, we don't touch a pen on Shabbos. That's a rabbinic decree that was made by one of the Sanhedrins. Why? Because you're not allowed to write on Shabbos, and if you touch a pen, you might come to write, and things like that, right? Not to handle money, not to do a lot of things we don't do on Shabbos are rabbinic in nature, because they were made by some Sanhedrin along the way in order to... those are the three functions. And whatever they come up with, as the Torah tells in this week's parasha, becomes binding and needs to be... It's obligatory to be kept by all of Klal Yisrael. Now, what happened when that Sanhedrin finished? What happens today, for example? So, two out of the three things don't exist, but the third one still does. And this is very important to understand how it works. What doesn't apply today is they cannot make new mitzvahs. Okay. What also doesn't apply today is that no beis din or no great or halachic authority can enact a new decree. Right? That's binding on everyone. Because once Klal Yisrael became decentralized, particularly from the time of the split between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, right, where the communities were no longer together, nothing could be enacted that became binding on the whole Jewish people. So, simple example, even when things were accepted by large communities, it didn't become obligatory for other communities. Simple example, kitnius on Pesach, rice on Pesach, right? At the time when it was made post-Talmud times. It was some sort of precautionary decree about because they grew near wheat or they looked too much like wheat, whatever the case was. Ashkenazi communities accepted upon themselves this law, and therefore today it becomes obligatory for an Ashkenazi to keep it. Sephardi communities didn't, and therefore Sephardim still eat kitnias till today. In fact, it becomes so popular that if you spend Pesach in Israel, you actually have to really watch what you're buying if you're an Ashkenazi, right? If you're buying Pesach products. It's actually quite confusing, apparently, it's become, right? And things like that. So they cannot make new decrees that will be binding on the whole Klal Yisrael. What the function of Torah legislators still remains till today, and I'm going to explain why in a minute, because part of the fundamental system of Torah law and its eternity is the combination and the teamwork between the written Torah and the oral Torah, right? And that continues, that system continues until today. In a different way, but it continues until today. Like what? Till today we have principles, we have questions that come up that were never dealt with before. So one of the famous examples that our generation has had to deal with is organ transplant. For example, I'm not going to give you an organ transplant now, I just want to tell you the system, okay? It's a very complex thing. Why is it a new question, or relatively new question? Because it necessitates halacha. I'm just sort of giving you an example of how this whole thing works. Necessitates halacha to deal with issues we never had to deal with. Like defining the moment of death. Right? It was never that relevant. Someone died, they died. I mean, it was fine. So you made it until you were sure they were no longer alive, and that was fine. Nowadays, it's critical to know the defining moment of death. Why? Because in organ transplant, for example, when you need a heart from someone, so you cannot take a heart from a living person, that's considered murder. On the other hand, it needs to be a fresh heart from a heart that's still beating, which now that's what became the basis for the entire question, right? What is the moment of death? Is it, to simplify the question, is it brain death or is it heart death, right? Often you have a person who's already brain dead, but their heart is still beating. Are they still alive? If they're no longer alive, it should be okay to take their heart, especially to save another life. Putting aside all the questions of autopsy, things like that, but essentially to save another life, you can do it. Provided the person is considered no longer alive, even though his heart is beating. If you say the moment of death is when the heart stops beating, well, then that's a problem. You can't take his heart because the person is still alive, right? So that's just an example of a new question that came up in our generation. So how does it deal with, based on this week's parsha, how do we do this? So we can't do it in a Sanhedrin fashion because we don't have a Sanhedrin, right? So when Klal Yisrael was centralized, right, it all went to Sanhedrin. What would the Sanhedrin do with it if they had such a question? A new question came about, comes to them and say, what do they do with it? So they debate it, much like it's debated today. They see, okay, they do a few things. They have a look, what is written or what has been established on this concept to date? Has any halacha been established in this regard so far? Right? Because one of the systems of Torah Shabbat Peh is once a halacha has been established, it cannot be undone. It's all part of the Torah Shabbat Peh system, right? So has anything, what's the precedent? What's been written about this till now or spoken about it till now? Then what are the sources that we have till now which will be similar to this idea? And then we have to see how do we interpret it, how do we analyze it without deviating from the parameters and the rules of interpretation which God gave us at Har Sinai. Okay? And then it's possible, because people think differently and interpret differently, with using the same rules and the same database and the same information, they still might come to different conclusions, which is the beauty of Torah learning, that we can use the same rules, stick to the same system, and yet come up with different views, which is fine. As long as we're sticking to the same system, right? So we don't have a free range there's an amazing flexibility in the oral Torah learning, but as long as we stay within a certain system, the divine system, God's system. As soon as we go out of that system, it's not Torah anymore. But many times in the Sanhedrin, there was arguments, just like we have today. Different views. Why? Because they use the same sources, the same rules of interpretation, but everyone thinks differently. So they try their best, they come up with a different answer, right? Which is fine. The reason we don't have a record of those arguments, as we do later on in the Mishnah and the Talmud, is because they were resolved within a few minutes. As soon as there were different views, they took a vote. Once they took a vote, they followed the majority. Once they took a majority, it was established. The halacha was done. Okay? That's how it used to work in Sanhedrin times. However, there came a time when the Sanhedrin split, even before the end of the Mishnah and the Talmud, which the very first recorded arguments in the Torah, in the Talmud, is those between Hillel and Shammai, or more importantly, Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. That was towards the end of the Second Temple, where things declined and there was two different schools of learning. Both had respect for each other, both worked with each other, but they were different. And therefore, that was the beginning of what we have today in abundance, the beginning of what we talk about, different communities. Right? So much so. So for example, after that, when there would be new questions, things would come about and there would be different answers. The community of Shammai would be doing what Beis Shammai said to do. The community of Beis Hillel was doing what Beis Hillel said to do. Now, which one was doing right?
Both.
Exactly. Because that is the beauty of the Oral Torah. The Oral Torah makes us partners in the Torah. And until it can be resolved in a unanimous way, you work it out the way Torah wants you to work it out, and that is the will of God. So as long as they, both Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel, both kept the same system, right? They came up with different answers. Whoever was part of their community and following their rules was doing what Hashem wanted them to do, even though it was totally different things. So much so, I'll tell you an amazing thing. And this is probably something that's probably very lacking today, which we need to work on. But Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel came up with different views, but they had tremendous respect for each other. So much so, the Gemara says the most, I'm sure you've heard me say this before, but the Gemara says the most fascinating thing. Fascinating. There was we can't go into it now because time would never allow it, but there's a very complex law in Yibum, which we don't have today, but the Yibum means when someone dies without children and his widow marries the deceased brother, but only in certain circumstances, right? Certain circumstances, it's a mitzvah, certain circumstances actually forbidden. And you have two extremes. In the circumstances where it's forbidden, then the man to marry his sister-in-law is actually a terrible avera, to the point that the children would be mamzerim. And if it's a mitzvah, then it's a mitzvah, right? So it's either or. You have to get it right. It's either a mitzvah or it's a bad thing. Anyway, there was a particular scenario of Yibum, without going into details, where I think Beis Hillel said it was forbidden, Beis Shammai said it was okay. It was a mitzvah. Or vice versa, I don't remember. So you can imagine what goes on, right? Yeah, right? So they're ruling on the same question. Not talking about, you know, if you could use a peeler on Shabbos. They're talking about big things now. We're talking about like a certain marriage. And it's an urgent question. Is this marriage a mitzvah? Mitzvah, the levirate marriage, the Yibum? Or is it a marriage which is so bad that it could produce a mamzer, which will be then restricted in marrying into the mainstream community and so on and so forth? So in one community, this marriage is a mitzvah. This marriage is a terrible, right? The Gemara says that the two communities would marry into each other. However, they would have such respect for each other that if a shidduch was suggested, right, where let's say from the community that held it was not a good marriage, with a girl that was born from such a marriage, the other community would say, listen, this shidduch is not for you. Because you, in your community, are actually not permitted to marry this girl. Well, our community is not a problem, but in your community, it's a problem. So maybe think of something else. That's the level of respect they had for each other. Why? Why do they respect each other so much? Because they both understood, both communities understood, that they're working with the same system. They're working with the same Torah, using the same rules, not deviating, right? Not making up their own stuff. And within that process, they're coming out with different views, and that's fine. We can respect each other. I say that level of respect is something probably we need to work on today, but that's a bit missing today. But that should be there, and that could be there, as long as it's in the same system, right? I mean, we have to respect everyone, but in terms of legitimacy. So going back to our organ transplant question, for example, how would it work today? Same thing. So what is so first of all, these questions don't go to regular rabbis. They've got to go to specialists, right? Number one. So, you know, everyone, I always tell people, like, I'm a GP. You can't ask me big questions. I can tell you what it says. For big things, you have to go to specialists, right? So there are great halachic authorities in the world. There are batei din. There are great poskim and so on and so forth. They deal with new questions and deal with really difficult questions. What do they do? How does the system work? How do you... See, it's all based on a belief that Torah is eternal, and therefore there cannot be a question where we cannot find a Torah answer for. That's the principle here. Why? Because the Zohar tells us that when God created the world, He looked into the Torah and He created the world. In other words, the Torah is not a commentary or a handbook for a particular society. The world is an outcome of Torah. Torah is the blueprint of creation. So therefore, part of the foundational belief in the eternity of the Torah is that the Torah contains questions to everything. It contains answers to every question. You just have to know how to look for it. So what would be the system if something totally new comes up because of technology or medical advance and so on and so forth? So the question, so the answer goes, the process goes like this. The great Rav or the Beis Din or any halachic authority like Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Eliashiv, or any great Beis Din that is dealing with issues like that, first thing they do is, especially nowadays where so much has been written over the ages, we look for any responsa throughout the ages, any halachic literature that has addressed this issue at all. Okay? That's the process. Because if something's already been written and something's already been established, you don't have to reinvent the wheel, and you can't reinvent the wheel. Now, when it comes to these kind of questions, nothing's been written about it. I mean, what's been written about it, right? So then if they can't, I mean, organ transplant was not something they did until very recently. So you go back and you try to find something similar. What is similar in the literature that could attach itself to this particular dilemma? So in this particular case, I believe that you can't find anything, but you have to go all the way to Gemara. And there's one passage in the Talmud which holds the key to this dilemma. I say there's always something, there's always some source, it's amazing, that can be a starting point. And I don't remember all the details of the passage now, but it's a passage which talks about a house that collapses on Shabbos and falls upon someone. So someone's trapped under rubble, right? Now, normally, ordinarily, a collapsed house on Shabbos, that's just stones. There's no human beings there. You can't move the stones because it's muktzah. You're not allowed to. It's a violation of Shabbos to clear the stones. You'd have to wait till after Shabbos. In this case, obviously, you can definitely start clearing the stones because there's a live person under there, right? And therefore, we know we can transgress Shabbos to save someone's life. So you do it, and you keep doing it until you find the person. Provided the person is alive, you keep working, you keep clearing the rubble until you can rescue the person and do whatever you need to do. Once you've got the person out, then you have to leave the rest of the rubble there till after Shabbos, right? Okay. So Gemara discussed what happens if you, I don't know exact detail, but it's something to do with what happens if you uncover and you don't uncover the head first, uncover the different parts of the body first. And basically, the Gemara then addresses how you tell that the person is still alive or not alive. And it deals there with breathing and the head and the heart and so on and so forth. And that passage becomes the key to this problem and all the commentaries on that passage, the early Talmudic commentaries of the passage and how you learn that passage and the exact wording of the different versions of the same Gemara. So I tell you an interesting thing. With this particular issue, all the halachic authorities that have been dealing with this issue all start from the same Gemara, the same passage. And yet they come up with different conclusions, which is fine. Again, they're using the same, they're all using exactly the same system. They're starting from the Gemara, they're looking for any other something that's been written on this issue before, and then they try their best to interpret the material they're working with, and they come with a conclusion, and the conclusion could be opposite, because there's different ways to learn a passage of the Talmud sometimes. Legitimate ways to learn a different passage of the Talmud, and they come up with a thing, right? And today, in fact, because we don't have a Sanhedrin, it remains, to date, an unresolved dispute. There are great batei din in the world that rule heart dead. There's a great batei din that rule brain dead, and that's fine. There are hospitals in Israel that follow one way. The hospitals in Israel follow a different way, and that's all good. They're both good because they're following their community, their rabbi, their process, and that's it remains an unresolved dispute. And every base in every city has to then decide which one they want to adopt and why they want to adopt that, whatever the case is, work it through themselves and come to a conclusion. Okay. Now, that's the system, how it works. Why does it work like that? Right? This is an important thing to understand. Why does it work like that? So one of the ways to understand it is like this. When God gave us the Torah, right, and this again, this is coming from this week's parasha, this is all sourced in this week's parasha, that the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, have this oral law, they're the caretakers of oral law, they have to adopt the process, has to go from one generation to the next. When God gave the Torah at Har Sinai, one of the fundamentals of Torah, of giving us the Torah, was that we should be partners to the Torah. That the Torah wasn't just a gift that God gave us that we should be passive, but that the Torah was something God gave us that we should partner in the Torah. It should become ours. I'm going to share with you an idea that comes actually from Parshas Bereishis. And I feel very safe doing that because Parshas Bereishis is the one parasha we never have a shir on. Especially this year, where Simchas Torah is Thursday, Friday, and Shabbos. So by the time we come to Tuesday, we're into Noach already, right? Bereishis is gone. So we're always safe to say stuff on Bereishis. So in Bereishis, we know we have the 6 days of creation, and on the fourth day, it says that God created the, what he calls the Shnei Me'orois HaGedolim, the two great luminaries, the sun and the moon, right? Very timely now that there's just been an eclipse, right? Sun and the moon. Then the very same verse continues and says, Es ha-mo'er ha-godel, the great luminary, was there to shine it during the day. Ves ha-mo'er ha-kata, in the smaller luminary, the moon, is there to shine at night. Yeah? Okay. So the Gemara says, the Talmud asks a famous question. What does this mean? The Torah starts off by saying that God created two great luminaries, and ended up by saying the bigger one and the smaller one. Are they two great, or is it one big, one small? So the Gemara tells us the famous Medrash, that what happened was Hashem originally created the sun and the moon equally. The moon then had complaints that it's not good for there to be two, you can't have two rulers, it's got to be one. So Hashem said, okay, no problem, make yourself smaller. L'chi mati es atzmech. Make yourself smaller. So that's why the moon became smaller. Originally it was two, then it became one. So the question the commentators asked, what is this supposed to mean? Was it a conversation or having? What does this all mean to us? So one of the explanations is as follows. The sun and the moon represent the two parts of Torah. The written Torah and the oral Torah. Why? We know the way the sun and the moon work is that the sun gives light. The moon does not produce light. The moon just reflects the light it receives from the sun. Right? So the sun is what we call a mashpia, a giver. The moon is what we call the receiver, the makabel. Similar to Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebaalpeh. The written Torah is God's prescribed words. It's the Chumash, the Tanakh. It's exactly God's words that He gave us together with the rules of interpretation. It's His contribution to the Torah. What's the oral Torah? The oral Torah is how we interpret the Torah, how we learn the Torah off by heart, how we expand on the verses, how we learn the halachas, how we respond to new questions, how we enact new decrees, and so on and so forth. Yeah? So that's why the written Torah is the sun, the oral Torah is the moon. So here comes the secret. The Torah does two things. Originally, we are told, they created equally, but then in practice, the one is smaller than the other. Why? Because that's exactly the way the partnership of the written Torah and the oral Torah work. On the one hand, in essence, the written Torah and the oral Torah are 100% equal. One doesn't have more authority than others. Often I've been asked the question, and it's such an important foundation about, you know, we'll learn a certain halacha or a certain practice, a certain thing that the Torah tells us we have to do. And someone will say to me, that's not written in the Torah, right? That's just from the Gemara, correct? I said, what do you mean? Well, it's in the Torah, it's more important. I said, no, that's not true. If it's written in the Gemara and the Talmud and it's been derived from the verses using the system of the oral Torah the way God gave it to us, it's as authoritative as the written Torah. It's as God's will as the written Torah. It makes no difference. It's just one was written, one was oral. That's the way it was given. That's the way the system works. The two luminaries are exactly the same. There's the famous story in the Gemara, right? The very, very famous story in the Gemara, which just demonstrates how this whole thing works, where there was the famous debate in a Sanhedrin, in Yavne actually, about a certain oven, whether it was pure or impure, a whole story. And most of the sages said one way, and I think Rabbi Eliezer, if I'm not mistaken, said the other way. He argued. And they both again used the same process, but they came to different conclusions. But this time it was a majority came to one conclusion, the other one came to... Now, normally the halacha is that you follow the majority. But Rabbi Eliezer was so adamant that he was right. He was so adamant that they made a mistake in what they'd done and how they'd gone through the process, that they'd made a mistake somewhere along the line, that he said to them, these were holy people, he said to them, if I'm right, let the trees prove it or something. And the trees started to shake wildly. And I said, too bad. And then he said, if I'm right, let the water stream dry up or something. And happened. Then he said, if I'm right, let the walls of the shul, of the base medrash, shake. And they did. And they just ignored him. And then he said, if I'm right, let there be a heavenly voice that should come out and say that I'm right. And it happened. The heavenly voice came out and said, Rabbi Eliezer is correct. And the rabbis turned to Rabbi Eliezer and said, too bad. We have a verse in the Torah that says, Lo bashamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. What does it mean? It comes later in Dvarim. What do you mean it's not in heaven? The Torah was given to us. We were given a system. We're following the system. We're trying our best. We are interpreting the way we best know how to do it without deviating one iota from the system that God gave us. This is the conclusion we come to. If it doesn't fit with the way they learn Torah in heaven, that's just too bad. Then the Torah tells us to, when we have a dispute, to follow the majority. That's exactly what we're doing. And Allah is like us. End of story. Says the Gemara, a few days later, Rabbi Yeshua was walking in the street and he met Eliyahu HaNavi. Eliyahu HaNavi, we know, the Elijah the prophet, appears to great people sometimes. So Rabbi Yeshua said to Eliyahu HaNavi, tell me, I've got an interesting behind-the-scenes question to ask you. When all this was happening, what was Hashem doing? Like, what was his reaction? So Eliyahu HaNavi said, Hashem was smiling and he was saying, Natschuni bonai natschuni, my children won. In other words, what does that mean? That they won because that's what I want to happen. In other words, that's my will. My will is, yes, in other words, if you, from the perspective of the way Torah is learnt in the upper worlds, which Kabbalistically we are told that Torah is not only learnt in this world, but is learnt in the upper world as well. True. The interpretation mightn't be wrong, but they follow the system. And therefore, their interpretation was correct. And they're the majority. So they win. And that's what I want them to do, because I want them to be partners in the Torah. And as authoritative as the written Torah. And that's why originally God creates the sun and the moon equally, because they're equally as authoritative. However, and this is the big however, in practice he makes the moon smaller. Why? Because for this to work, for the oral Torah to be authentic, for the oral Torah to be as authoritative as the written Torah, it must act as smaller. It must be subservient and derive its direction from the written Torah. And from the rules that were given to Moshe Rabbeinu of how to develop the oral Torah. Is that clear? In other words, the moon is as equal to the sun, the oral Torah is as equal to the written Torah, when the oral Torah acts subservient to the written Torah, when it takes its guidelines from the written Torah, and from the system, the process which is given to us by the written Torah. And that's really the important part. That's why in every age you had people who sprung up who decided, well, if we have that much leverage to change things, well, let's change things dramatically to suit the times. The problem is that when that happens and it's a deviation from the process, it's no longer Torah. As long as people are using the 13 principles of faith and the belief in the authenticity of both parts of the Torah, the written Torah and the oral Torah, and using the system exactly the way it was done, then even if it comes to different conclusions, that's fine. That doesn't matter. That's fine. But as soon as people rise up, which happens in every generation, and decide, well, if we've got that authority, let's extend it beyond the parameters, beyond the guidelines, and just come up with new innovations which actually are not based on the process, but they're innovative to an extreme where they're actually a deviation from the parameters that God set down for us, then it's no longer Torah. And that's where we have to be very careful from. So the moon is equal to the sun when the moon is subservient to the sun. And that's what the Torah is telling us over here. Al pi ha-Torah, according to the Torah which they will teach you. As long as it remains Torah, then you've got to do whatever they tell you to do, even if you think they made a mistake. But as long as it remains Torah and it connects to it, it maintains its authenticity. Just to end up, by the way, this concept He's very, very emphasized in the very first mitzvah that were given to the Jewish people as a nation, which was the mitzvah of making a calendar. Right? Where Hashem gave us that, that was the first mitzvah given to us as a nation in Egypt, because that in that mitzvah, especially when it was done in early times, it so emphasized how the partnership that Am Yisrael has in the whole process of Torah. Because it's a beautiful, you know, that in olden times specifically, they used to establish the Rosh Chodesh month by month basis. The witnesses would come and say they'd seen the new moon and so on, and they would do it. And they had to make all kinds of calculations, and sometimes they maybe were a bit off, and didn't matter. Because there's a famous medrash where the Malach, about Rosh Hashanah, coming up to Rosh Hashanah soon, where the Malachim say, the angels turn to God and they say, so when's the day of judgment? When's it going to be the culture of judgment in the world? When does the holiness of Rosh Hashanah kick in? And Hashem says, I don't know, let's go have a look. Let's see when they've made Rosh Hashanah this year. In other words, I'll fit in with the Jewish people when they make Rosh Hashanah, again, following the process. But when they make Rosh Hashanah, I'll... Because, you know, months can be 29 days or they can be 31 days, and it's up to the system. Okay, nowadays we have much more of a structured system, but in olden times it was month by month basis. And therefore, again, going back to the story of the Sanhedrin in Yavne, there was the famous story where... I think it was Rabbi Yeshua, who had a dispute with one Rosh Hashanah. He felt they made a mistake. And they made Rosh Hashanah on the wrong day. And Rabban Gamliel, who was the leader of the Sanhedrin, said to Rabbi Yeshua, I know you think we all made a mistake, but you've got to come on the Yom Kippur that you think is Yom Kippur. Because at the time, historically, Rabban Gamliel was very important for Rabban Gamliel to establish the authority of the Sanhedrin. He says, I want you to come on your Yom Kippur with your money belt and your food. In other words, I want you to violate Yom Kippur. And Rabbi Yeshua was depressed. He says, how can I do that? Yom Kippur. They all made a mistake. I know when Yom Kippur is. And he met Rabbi Akiva, and Rabbi Akiva says, what's wrong? What's up? Why are you looking so down? And he says, this is what happened. I can't do this. He says, no, Rabbi Akiva said, you're making a big mistake. You might be right. They might have made a mistake in the calculations, but they followed the process and they came up with, this is Yom Kippur. And if that's what they come up, that's when Yom Kippur really is. That's when the holiness of Yom Kippur falls in. So it's a very delicate balance. On the one hand, this is incredible contribution and partnership that the nation has in terms of how Torah is legislated. Yet it only remains authentic and real if we follow the system. So that's the sun and the moon being equal, but yet the moon being smaller than the sun. And that is all coming from this week's parasha, where the foundations of Torah Shabbat Peh, in a big way, there are a few places in the Torah, but mainly the foundations of Torah Shabbat Peh are from this mitzvah of following the Sanhedrin. Okay.
So,
see you tonight, Baruch Hashem. Yeah.
Is that from the Torah?
What do you mean the aguna? Okay, so that's a very interesting question.